Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and fresh from last month's special edition about the Pulford Awards, we are going to have another special edition almost immediately. In fact, stretching the very definition of what a special episode even is. This time, we are going to be talking about a book. It's a new book, a new tome that is going to be joining the groaning shelves of the library at Private Eye Towers. Joining such illustrious works as Love in the Saddle, Thomas the Privatized Tank Engine, The Secret Diary of Lord Gnome, aged 73 and 3/4, the new book, Private Eye, the 60 Yearbook, is going to be published in September, and we're going to be spending this episode talking about the book, unfolding its mysteries, finding out what's in it. I sat down with Adam McQueen, the book's editor. He is, of course, a Private Eye hack and no stranger to this podcast, and with Ian Hislop, the editor of the magazine itself. And I started off by asking Adam, Private Eye, the 60 Yearbook, what is it?
What it is not is a history of private eye.
Okay.
Because we've done that one. We did that for the 50th anniversary 10 years ago, as the mathematically gifted among you will be able to work out. So this, instead, we thought we'd do a different approach. We've done Private Eye's history of private eye. This is Private Eye's history of everything else, everything that's happened in the years from 1961 to 2021. So my kind of working title for it was ... as seen by Private Eye. So it's all of the big kind of historical events, the ones you remember, some of the ones you've completely forgotten about and would be quite surprised to read again, as seen through both the jokes pages of Private Eye, and then also because from fairly early on in the history it was doing some agenda setting scoops and journalism, we've got those in as well. So the big stories that the eye broke that were then followed up by everyone else over the last six decades as well.
Often when people write a biography of a particular time, they might restrict themselves to a decade. That's a really common one, or a particular year. This is the last 60 years of British history in a book of about 300 pages. How the hell did you pick what got in?
With great difficulty. I did have an idea at one point of pitching to Ian that we should do six volumes, one for each decade, and it would just be this enormous, it would be a bit like having the entire Oxford English Dictionary on your shelves. It helps, actually, that the magazine in the early years is much, much smaller than it is in later years. So there are far, far fewer pages and far, far more white space and bigger cartoons and bits of everything. So it wasn't quite as daunting as it got later on. I think I had to go to the opticians this week for an eye test, and it turns out my eyes have deteriorated considerably, which I'm putting down to basically spending 2 years reading the tiny... I've now got sympathy with all those readers who write in saying, your type is far too small in Private Eye. It's an enormous amount of stuff. And then I did sort of one decade, and that came in at about 300 pages, which is the length the book had to be. So then I whittled. Okay. I whittled enormously. And... tried to hit the big things, but also, I mean, you can't resist with it. Although it's not specifically a best of Private Eye for the last 60 years, that is effectively what it ends up being. So a lot of it is dictated by the jokes and kind of those really memorable covers and the jokes that really stand out as being particularly brilliant, whether or not the particular cabinet minister that was resigning at the time has dropped into obscurity since.
One of the things that I found surprising when reading through it is how early people pop up. And obviously, I shouldn't have been surprised by that, because that's a long-running thing and a long-running joke of the I told you so, is that Private Eye's been banging on about something for ages, and then people pick up on it. But, you've got 1966, there's a description of what happens at the Porton Down Germ Warfare Lab, which is still secretive today and still gets excitedly written about.
Look at the conspiracy theorising about that in recent years over the Salisbury poisoning and all the nonsense that was talked about that. And... they've been involved in the coronavirus research as well, haven't they? But I think the eye was one of the very first to pretty much reveal its existence and certainly what was going on inside it. And at the time, someone was sent round from the ministry to have some very stern words with the editor, Richard Ingrams, and point out that this was not the done thing. So, of course, they did it again a couple of years later.
When Adam presented what is this book, it seemed to me that we'd done books of cartoons and we'd done books about the history of ourselves, but we hadn't basically said... As the years went on, this magazine evolved into a rather strange entity in which you get what Adam called spoofs and scoops. The mixture of jokes and journalism is almost unique. Very few other papers do it. And, Le Canard Enchaîné in Paris and a few other imitators sort of worldwide. But essentially, it's quite a strange thing. And watching that grow is really interesting. And watching the way essentially... the journalism informs the jokes, and then the jokes can just keep on and on about a story in a way that makes it sort of less repetitive and less sort of earnest. And the two things feed into each other.
But it's almost disconcerting at first, seeing the jokes and the journalism right next to each other, whereas obviously readers will be used to journalism on the outside, jokes in the middle. But it does shake it up a bit, like a kaleidoscope, and you're suddenly seeing them next to each other, often on the same subjects.
The thing that is really apparent when you read through all of the back issues is it's obvious when Paul Foote is with the magazine in the older stuff. So he's not there at the beginning. He's off doing other things. Then he comes in towards the end of the 60s, and Porton Down is a great example of that. That was a footy, very early footy story. And then he sort of wanders away again in the 70s, and the stories, you'll see this in the shape of the book, because we literally divide each year into jokes and journalism. And the journalism sections, just literally in size, kind of wax and wane as you go through. So you then get towards the late 70s, and suddenly footy's back. And you've got enormous amounts of stuff about Jeremy Thorpe was the story that brought him back in. But from then on, there's all sorts of more investigative stuff. And then in the 80s, when Ian took over as editor, I remember him saying to me, "You know, one of the first things he wanted to do was get Paul back in." And suddenly, there you go. And we're off on this great run of stories from Lockerbie through... this is the point where he goes entirely blank. Help me out here.
The miscarriages, the Birmingham Six, Carl Bridgewater,
everything
as he goes. Yeah, the initial tax stuff, Mapley, beginning of outsourcing, PFI. You know, yeah.
But that's a very interesting thing, how the size of the journalism waxes and wanes, because there really isn't very much at the start. In fact, it's almost all jokes in those early pages, including a parody of The Birds, which is the sheep, which.
Yes.
It feels like such a cultural artifact. I can't imagine there being joke pieces published about Hitchcock's The Birds.
As they come out, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And there's a very early cartoon strip about Ian Fleming that comes out about the same time as Dr. No as well. So they really were there. They were kind of hitting those points very, very early on, right from the beginning.
Are there other things that have changed in the 60 years? Major changes. I mean, some of the jokes feel hauntingly familiar from jokes that I've tried to submit. I've been told, yeah, we actually did that in 1963 or whatever.
Well, one of the nice things is you see a lot of the I characters coming in and making their earliest appearances. And one of the most amazing things I discovered is that I think Glenda Slagg, who is still with us to this day, the doyen of columnists, actually makes her first appearance around the time of the moon landings, which obviously was one of those big points I wanted to hear. And you get the triple with this, because the way that the Eye covered the moon landings in 1969 is that Lord Nome sends Lunchtime Obus to the moon to report back from the lunar surface. And when questions come up about how Lunchtime Obus was able to do this ahead of any of the other reports of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landing on the moon, Lord Nome points out in a very enraged editorial that, of course, this is because the moon is over 2 million light years away, as any schoolboy knows, and it follows that events taking place on the moon do not accord with our own earthly time scheme, which is how the Eye gets to scoop everyone their very first pictures of the surface of the moon, which look not very much like the surface of the moon, oddly enough. But also that same week, there she is, Glenda Slagg, complaining that we can put a man on the moon now in 1969, and yet I can't even get British Telecom to come round and fit a telephone in my apartment so I can get through to the editor after lunchtime. Wake up, Mr. Postmaster General.
That's not only all of journalism encapsulated, but most...
But it does show you quite how much nothing's changed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Another element of the book that's scattered through is the prime ministerial diaries, like, for example, the Albion Parish News. You know, in 1997, you see Tony, the new vicar. There are bits of Dear Bill, the Thatcher letters.
There are, yes, yeah, yeah. No, you kind of string those through. I mean, it would have been incredibly easy just to do the history of the Thatcher years just through the letters of Dear Bill. But actually, they get madder as she gets madder. And one of my favourite bits is quite late on in her reign, where Nigel Lawson resigned as Chancellor. And Bill just describes her as following him down the stairs, snapping off the banisters in her fury as she went, which is just wonderful. But we follow all of those through. It's really nice to see the kind of evolution of those, right from Mrs. Wilson's diary at the beginning, right through to we get one of the very first of the People's Prime Minister's press conferences on Fakebook in there at the end. So it's really fun to see those kind of evolving things streaming through. And the same with Craig Brown. Craig Brown joins in sort of 1986 or so, and it's really nice to be, although he's not necessarily commenting on contemporary news events always, it's really nice to be able to drop in just a few bits and pieces of those. I couldn't get Yoko Ono in. Yoko Ono was the very first, Yoko Ono's Diary by Craig Brown was the very first thing that made me think, oh, this is good. And I'm not sure I really knew particularly who Yoko Ono was, and certainly didn't know who Craig Brown was, but here I am, however many years later.
I do think the prism of the Prime Minister gives you a real focus into each decade into each era. And I entirely forgotten a great deal of the John Major years with The Secret Diary, which is, it is surprisingly how accurate not only the tone of him, but the tone of a slightly dull Britain that we've forgotten
about. The
Cones
Hotline. Charter marks, yes.
The Cones Hotline. Actually, I felt quite nostalgic for dullness, I'll be honest. I couldn't quite see what we were objecting to half the time. But the parodies are, they are very different, but they are very good catch-all references for jokes. And also for mood, I think, which is, again, goes very well with the journalism.
There's also the news parodies as they run through, particularly the newspapers with the strongest voices, like The Sun, for example. You've, during the Falklands War, you've got in, you know, the Killarney and Winner Metro.
Had to spoof, be there.
Which, yeah, Michael Foot is hanging too good for him. Is the Pope gay? 10 telltale signs. Those really strong...
I remember that writing session as if it was yesterday. There was one about trade union rosters as well, which is in itself a parody of Lysistrata.
Yeah, flexible rostering Aslef wives to ration love. Is that what we're talking about?
That's the one.
There we go.
They don't just think these things up, these jokes, you know. They're proper.
They have classical references embedded.
Classical references the editor of this book may completely have missed, but there we go.
Well, the editor at the time was a classicist.
It's really interesting what you say about colour and atmosphere, because a lot of that does come from the little side notes. So it's the names, the spoof names you drop into Sylvie Crin, or the particular cereals that John Major is eating at any given time. You suddenly go, oh God, yes, no, it just gives you a little snapshot of that time and an oddly sort of nostalgic feel, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, Fruit Loops are very, very important
deeply
culturally. not only reflecting the character of the people who might eat them. If you add in the Prime Minister of parodies and then the royal parodies, which go on and on. I mean, Sylvie Crin, the shampoo-based romantic novelist, is way back in the Eyes history. And she's been writing breathless prose about the royal family for, what, 40, 50 of those years? Or is it earlier than that?
It's the 70s she comes in. It's early 70s. She doesn't start off with the royals. She started off with the love story between Anna Ford and Reggie Bosanquet. But she gets on to Princess Anne and Love in the Saddle fairly quickly.
There's one for the younger.
Well, I was going to say Sylvie Crin is one of the things. Most younger listeners will probably not even remember that that was a shampoo brand these days. It's going to be one of those things like when the BBC went to court to prove against the Metropolitan Police to prove that more people thought of police boxes as being the TARDIS than anything to do with the police, and won the case. Sylvie Crin is now just a romantic novelist.
Well, yes, and that in British life, the royal family is the joke that keeps on giving. I mean, it is part of the constitutional role and will eventually be written down as one of their jobs when the slimmed-down monarchy arrives. You know, point seven will be you have to provide comic material.
So just as a quick example of the kind of things that fit into each decade, 1960s, obviously, Private Eye 1961 was the first issue, October 1961, and that starts with things like the Profumo scandal, the satire boom, the 14th Earl of Hume being the Prime Minister.
The funny thing about this, but people still think of Private Eye as being this terribly 60s thing, but that really is an incredibly short period of its life, and I think it really starts to develop its own voice after that, because you suddenly get Wilson coming in. And that's when Mrs. Wilson's Diary begins, which is the first of those kind of really long-running jokes and the prime ministerial parodies that you then go on to things like Dear Bill and the Vicar of St. Albion's and St. Teresa's and things. And that, I think, is really interesting because they got Wilson really, really early on. They got this kind of slightly Pooterish, Walter Mitty-ish figure and put him firmly in suburbia rather than the corridors of power. And I think that was a real insight that was that saw them a long way along the line. And of course, you get the very beginnings of journalism in the 60s as well, because you get Claude Coburn gets brought in, who is this investigative journalist who was very, very famous in the 1930s. I mean, he was a very old man by the time he joined those who came on to be the old men of private eye, like Christopher Booker and Richard Ingrams and Barry Fantoni.
The idea that, the eye was somehow a product of the swinging 60s. It was almost the first to have a go at the swinging 60s, and for its founders to realise they didn't like the swinging 60s very much, and then immediately to start attacking the new, exciting, idealistic left-wing government, which they were meant to support, having been furious about the Tories, they suddenly thought, oh, Mrs. Wilson. And that's, of course, allied with, you know, an editorial decision to get in someone incredibly left-wing, Claude Coburn. You couldn't find anyone more left-wing to write some journalism. So it is a very strange mix. And as the decades go on, I think you find that the thing about the eyes is it's not representative of the decade because it's largely not in tune with it, because writers, journalists, comedians, on the whole, are taking a different slant. So it is interesting to look back to see, as Adam was saying earlier, the mood is captured, but also... Well, this lot aren't quite going along with what everyone else is.
I don't think it always did them much good in terms of the readership. I mean, I know sort of 64 when Wilson comes in, there's a massive drop off in readership because people are kind of going, well, hang on, you were supposed to be having a go at the Tories. We don't like this at all. And there was an odd point. I remember back in the late 90s where the Eye seemed to be very much out of step with the rest of the media's coverage of Blair, who was, again, a bit like Wilson. He was this fantastic, new, exciting leader. And the Eye was kind of there going, no, actually, he's a bit ridiculous. He's a bit like a vicar. And almost immediately you get then the tobacco donation at the end of 1997. And there's this real sense that all the rest of the media are kind of going, oh, hang on, and sort of catching up with the Eye's take on things.
70s, one of the stories that I think people will remember more, probably because of recent coverage of it, is the coverage of Harold Wilson's political secretary, Marcia Williams, Lady Forkender, known as Lady Forkbender in Private Eye, because this all ties in to the Jeremy Thorpe story.
And not only tied in with them, but they also tied in with them is Jimmy Goldsmith, who was the man who attempted to sue one of the many men who attempted to sue the Eye out of existence, but one of the more effective ones at it. I mean, actually was suing the then editor, Richard Ingrams, and one of the hacks, Patrick Marnham, for criminal libel. I mean, which is, you know, could have put them in prison. He wasn't messing around. More than 100 libel writs in a matter of a few months, not just at the Eye, but all of the distributors as well, and sort of individual news agents, some of which were actually owned by Jimmy Goldsmith, because he had such extensive business interests. He was actually suing his own employees. So yeah, you get all of that. But I think that is a mark of how much and how quickly Private Eye became dangerous. Because, I mean, the journalism really doesn't get going until the very, very end of the 60s. But by 1972, it's forced out the Home Secretary, Reginald Maudling. And this is one of those scoops which will mean absolutely nothing to younger readers, and older readers may even have forgotten it. But the Poulsen scandal was this enormous web of corruption involving architects and town planning departments and councillors all across, largely the northeast of England, but right across down into the south as well, down into the constituency of Reginald Maudling, who was the Home Secretary, who had a swimming pool put in for free in him and his wife's house by Poulsen, which didn't even it had a big crack in the bottom and all of the water ran out of it. You know, this man was an inept architect as well as a corrupt architect. But this was a huge story, and it was disentangled largely by Paul Foote. And again, it was one of those cases where everyone else caught up kind of a year in or a couple of years later. But it involved a lot of people going to prison and the Home Secretary having to resign. So yeah, that's a mark of quite how effective the Eye was from a very early stage.
But it's also brilliant in the detail of the 70s, that rather dreary and useless decade, that the swimming pool, this supposed new glamorous style that we'd got from the continent, and we couldn't even get one in that didn't have a crack in it. Even the corruption was rubbish.
The 80s, surely the Thatcher years only, except... that there's lots of other stuff in there as well, but obviously probably the magazine's coverage of Thatcher is what most people think of.
She absolutely dominates everything, yeah, except in the eye where she's not allowed to, and we let her husband dominate everything instead. That was the wise decision to actually have a more likable character. Not always likable. Fantastically racist, the Dennis in Dear Bill, I realised when I went back to it. It's not quite as cosy and nice as you might think.
Were the bits that didn't get in because you thought that's aged terribly?
There are a few bits from the 60s and the early 70s, as I think there probably would be if you went back through any newspaper archive or went back to, you know, BBC programmes from that period or anything, that you think, that's a bit off, that's a bit close to the bone. But also, I think you do have to... You have to reflect that in a certain way. I mean, in a lot of cases with the eye, and this isn't just me making excuses for it, but they are making jokes of parodying that kind of thing. So certainly when you get on to Enoch Powell making his Rivers of Blood speech, it's really nice to see that the eye is bang there on the right side of history. And, of course, that very famous cover, which is one of the things that absolutely had to go in, of Enoch Powell after the Rivers of Blood speech, holding his arms out wide and saying, "And I tell you, some of them have got them this long." And the eye really were on to Enoch Powell and followed it up in the following years as well. So there's another nice thing from 69. So I think that's a couple of years afterwards, isn't it? Where is Powell's new bombshell: 100% of coloured births are coloured. An amazing statistic produced by Mr. Powell shows that young immigrant women between the ages of 17 and 30 have more children than white women aged 70 to 95.
I had some conversations with Adam, who, because he's actually editing the book, about pieces from the early days that look a bit iffy. And I said, well, you know, there isn't much space. And really, I think it might be better. And he put them in anyway. So, yes, I mean, you know, there will be things in there where you think things have changed. I think he wanted to reflect that.
When we come to the 90s, suddenly, this is all feeling alarmingly modern. It's probably because this is the decade when I started reading Private Eye, so there we go. But you've...
It's yesterday!
You've got all sorts of people who've actually been appearing for a while now, not least Robert Maxwell, the death of Robert Maxwell in 1991, who was also a major player in the magazine in the 80s, or at least in trying to shut it down. Lots and lots of royal scandals. The discovery of Mohammed Fayed and him becoming a bête noire for the whole decade.
Well, this was one of the really interesting things I read, because it's an odd thing trying to divide things into decade, because they're sort of a completely arbitrary grouping. But I read quite how well things do slot. And one of the ways that it worked really well is Private Eye has literally a villain for the 70s, who is Jimmy Goldsmith. It has a villain for the 80s, who is Robert Maxwell. And then a villain for the 90s, who is Mohammed El Fayed. It's like we've got to have one of these bugbears. And because of the way we're not very wise in picking our enemies, they've got to be incredibly rich and litigious as well.
I mean, we're worse than Bond. We just pick ludicrous megalomaniac billionaires.
But yeah, that, I mean, through the 90s is an incredible thing with Fayed, because you have Gillard in particular looking at the financing of the Harrods bid back in the 80s and all the dodgy stuff that went on with that. As with so many things, it takes everyone else a little while to catch up. So it's only when all the brown envelope stuff starts coming out. And even at that point, Fayed is still seen as this kind of hero to a lot of people. I mean, he was on the Guardian side. It was him exposing terrible behaviour and the acceptance of bribes and brown envelopes by government ministers. And it sort of gets overlooked, the fact that he was actually the one doing the bribing and handing over the brown envelopes. So again, you've got Private Eye kind of going, hang on a second, actually, let's think about this. And then, of course, the involvement with Diana and then her death in 1997, it kind of adds a whole new element to all of that.
The sheer pleasure of going along to court in those days and finding, oh, this is a case, it's Fayed versus the Hamiltons, Neil Hamilton and his wife, and sitting in the court and looking around and thinking, I don't care who wins.
Can they all lose, please?
The 2000s were a decade of Private Eye winning a libel suit. Very excitingly, libel has obviously been a big feature of the Eye's history.
Yeah, no, this was an extraordinary thing that happened in the 2000s, was we started winning legal cases. One right at the beginning, which dated back, goodness knows how many years, at least 10, I think, which was over a very obscure Cornish accountant in a piece that it was sort of consumer column that the Eye ran for a while, which is not something you can even imagine us doing now. But that's literally how important the story was. It was about a Cornish accountant overcharging clients. And it ended up, didn't it, Ian, as this enormous great case involving Carter Fuck. And incredibly expensive lawyers and lasting years.
Years. And originally a story essentially about an accountant ripping off elderly clients. And it turned into sitting in the High Court with busloads of files, which took weeks to reorder, and particularly when the lawyers deliberately reordered them in order to make some more money. And finally, we won. Not really through the legal process, but because thieves fell out and the client fell out with his own lawyers and then suddenly didn't have any lawyers and turned up one morning and there was no one there. And this vastly long and incredibly boring, to be honest, court case, which had been going on, imploded. It literally blew up. The judge was absolutely furious with the other side and we found we'd won.
And not only that, you then got a taste for it because there was another great big victory, this time on privacy, which had kind of replaced libel as the way to make money in the courts. Right at the end of the decade, wasn't there, with the lawyer who tried to injunct us with the privacy injunction.
Again, this was the president of the Law Society trying to prevent publication of the fact that he'd been criticised by the Ombudsman, which you would have thought was pretty much a slam dunk win. Easily for journalism, but oh no, we had to shut up for 4 months. It cost about £250,000 in damages, but a terrific win.
And anyway, that brings us on to the final decade so far in the Eye's history, the 2010s. Adam, do you care to nominate a particular bête noire of the magazine here?
Tax, I think. It's amazing when you go back and read through the Eye that, I mean, we get Richard Brooks joining in about 2004, 2005-ish, isn't it? And he was an ex-employee of Her Majesty's Revenue. So he was the man who knows his way round tax bills and accounts and things, and has all sorts of skills which most journalists don't have. And he started banging away at this stuff, firstly with the help of Paul Foote and then by himself for a long time. And suddenly that went right onto the agenda. I think it was really a case of the Private Eye setting not just the journalistic agenda, but the political agenda. And we've got a nice quote here from Margaret Hodge, who became the terrier at the Commons Accounts Committee after all of these tax dodgers, who said pointed out that all of the initial intelligence for her investigations, her committee's investigations, came not from HMRC officials or the National Audit Office, but from my regular reading of Private Eye. And she asked a sort of rhetorical question. Should we really rely on Private Eye to do due diligence on individuals who are given public appointments? And the answer is yes, of course you should. You should all take out subscriptions to Private Eye and buy this book just to catch up on what we've said in the past as well. But yeah, no, that's a case of us really, really setting the pace on that one, I think.
And Richard Brooks, I always reckon he took his own irritation with the fact that both high-level individuals and corporations don't pay any tax, made the public share that irritation, which is pretty irritating when you're paying tax yourself. And then finally, he ended up seeing it, you know, number two on the agenda of a G7 meeting, which is quite a good record for journalism.
It also felt, as I was putting together this particular decade of coverage, it felt like about five decades, you know, crammed into the last one, because there is so much been going on politically. You get how many governments we had in that time. We had the coalition, then we had Cameron for a little while, and then he went over the EU referendum, and then we had Theresa May, and at the same time you've got Corbyn, and you've got the Scottish referendum, and all of that going on during the same sort of period, and then finally, and sort of horribly, inevitably, you get around to Boris and Dominic Cummings and people. So it's all in there. I'm trying to keep track of it. My one really sinking feeling moment when I was putting this together was when I got to 2018 and I realised, oh God, I'm going to have to do all of that Brexit stuff, all of that legislation.
This is the first mention of the B word. We want people to buy this book, Adam.
So I should just point out, I've done it in a News in Brief column. But it is, it's a, you know, we're talking about these things that you've completely forgotten about, but things like the Bowles Amendment and all of these things that seemed enormously important and took up enormous numbers of column inches at the time and just sort of faded into this slight sense of chaos. And actually, brilliantly, there is one cover, which is the one directly after the referendum in 2016, which does a lot of it. It was a multi-bubble cover, and it was that week that absolutely everyone resigned. And I can remember being in the office and us having editorial meeting after editorial meeting, because when we decided what we were doing, suddenly someone else had gone. You come back and go, now Farage has resigned. Now this person's resigned. Another person's gone. But actually, all of that kind of went into one cover, which tells an awful lot of the story by itself, which was a relief for me anyway. I didn't have to explain it all in great length. I'll be really interested to see how people read this book, because everyone, when they get the copy of the magazine, has their favourite column or their favourite bit that they go to first. And with this, I would imagine that everyone who gets it will look at the year they were born and then realise that they can't remember any of the news stories from the year they were born because they were a baby, and then sort of flick to some bits a bit later on in life and bits they do remember, or whether they'll just start at the beginning and read this whole thing through chronologically. One of the things it does, which it hadn't really occurred to me until I actually saw it happen on the page, was it's really nice to see all of the stories on a certain subject together. So, for instance, in 2001, you get all of the 9/11 coverage and the war in Afghanistan and the beginning of the war on terror that goes on to Iraq and stuff, kind of all together. It's from about 4 or 5 months different issues, but they're together. And then in 2007, 2008, in the journalism sections, you get kind of all of Michael Gillard, Slicker's and Richard Brooks' coverage of the financial crisis. And it's really good to kind of see that as a package rather than kind of sort of spread out over, you know, CIs, PASIM and referring people back all the time. And conversely with that, it's really good with some stories to see how they develop over time. So, for instance, the Lockerbie story, which is started off by Paul Foote, carried on by Heather Mills later on. It's really interesting to see that develop literally through decades, because that's the thing that the eye does, because Ian is quite willing to keep banging on about things forever when they need banging on about. So you get those two things, which are a totally different experience to kind of reading them in the magazine.
I was very well aware that the great satirist Alexander Pope, everybody at the time said, your stuff's not going to last, you know. The stuff, you write some very nice dramatic poems about woods. That's what people like. And in the end, you're just, you know, people won't be able to read you without footnotes, so you'll be washed up. And my pleasure in A, you know, no one reads any of Pope's romantic stuff. It's incredibly boring. and they still read his jokes. But B is reading old eye jokes right next to the journalism that's about it. So you don't need footnotes. You've got a piece. That's incredibly pleasing.
I was going to ask about that cutting down process of obviously all the jokes about, for example, the war on terror and all the journalism, because you take a look at, let's say, the really recent stuff, the coronavirus coverage, you've basically taken one bit of MD's stuff from each month of the last year. I mean, that's a real boiled down process.
But what was interesting about that, because it was a big question of where we were going to stop this and at what point Ian was going to wrest it out of my hands and send it off to the printers. I mean, 2020, you know, I was kind of putting that stuff into the book as MD Phil Hammond was writing it. But it was incredible to see, even in miniature within that 1 year, how the I told you so approach works. Because right there at the beginning of the year, you've got him talking about the need for a decent track and trace system and saying this one that they're setting up is not that system. It isn't going to work. And then very, very early on in the year, you've got questions being raised about very dodgy looking contracts going to Tory donors and things. So it's all of these stories that have kind of multiplied and magnified as that year and then this year have gone on. But you kind of get that just in the space of a page of 2020.
You know, that story will go on. Phil has in no sense given up. And you'll be able to read a lot more about that elsewhere.
The more recent stories, you see that they are still evolving. So the Dominic Cummings press conference, which was last year in the garden at Downing Street, where he says, on March 27th, I did nothing wrong. On March 28th, I made the decision to do nothing wrong again. For the next 9 days, I did nothing wrong again. Once or twice during that time period, I may have done nothing wrong. Which is, we've just seen repeated, obviously, in the select committee appearances made. And, you know, I'm sure we'll go on seeing for a few years yet. So it's nice that you've laid the breadcrumbs for what comes next in each of them.
I like the idea that Adam's had to have a genuine eye test because he's been reading all the
Cummings. I'll send you the bill, Ian. I'll send you the bill.
Yeah. But that's the other thing. I mean, one thing you don't get when you read the magazine, obviously, is what comes next. You know, and actually in the journalism, Adam, you've provided digests of, you know, 20 years later, a public inquiry opened into this matter or whatever, which is quite satisfying to read. And it's also a bit depressing, I'm afraid, because of how long it is between story and inevitable public inquiry or resignation.
It's not as depressing as if I'd included all of the stories where the public inquiry still hasn't happened.
And, sure.
And nothing got done. But no, I mean, it is really pleasing to see. So, I mean, for instance, the contaminated blood inquiry, which is going on at the moment. And I think Heather's doing a story on it for this issue as we speak. You know, 1987, first mention of that. With, again, Paul Foote is just straight on it. And it is enormously pleasing. And the other nice thing in terms of the editing process was all of this went off to our lawyer, Robin. And I was kind of thinking, this is going to be terrible because he's going to come back to me and say, well, how do you prove this story? And I'll have to say, well, I don't know, because this story was written by someone else in 1973. And I don't have documentary evidence. He didn't. In fact, the only thing he came back with was a couple of stories where he said, I think we're going to have to pull these because there are ongoing court cases connected to them and there's a risk of prejudicing it. And I said, oh, God, which ones are they? Well, one was from 2012, which is quite a significant time ago. One was from 1985, which was really, really pleasing that finally someone might be banged to rights. So those have gone in with enormous black redacted things on, saying lawyer has removed, which is quite pleasing to be able to do as well.
If anything gives a flavour of the magazine, it's not being able to read a page because someone sued us.
So there you have it. The book is going to be published on the 2nd of September. Buy it now before further legal threats mean it has to be pulped. That is it for this extended advert. Sorry, I mean this episode of Page 94. We are going to be back again next month with another episode of the podcast. Will it be a further special episode? It's impossible to say at this stage. Tune in then to find out. Thanks very much for listening. This episode, as always, has been produced by Matt Hill. Goodbye.